Greetings to you in cyberspace. This audio message is part one of a four-part series put together for my website to defend the Judeo-Christian worldview as an accurate reflection of true reality. If you are listening with Windows Media Player, you may want to play the file faster and can access this feature by clicking on the View tab, then Enhancement, then click on Play Speed Settings. Next, open up the audio file in Windows Media Player, then stop it. Now you can uncheck the snap slider control box and with your mouse can choose any speed on the scale. I found somewhere between 1.2 to 1.3 times normal speed works best. Other media players should have a similar feature also. I am speaking as fast as I can, but my budget digital recorder seems a slight bit slower than real time. Okay, let's begin. By way of introduction, my name is Alan Ask, currently living in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I maintain a website covering the creation science worldview versus the evolutionary science worldview, Bible prophecy, the rapture, and how to know and walk with the true God of creation. I hope to do a number of series for the internet covering Bible prophecy and discipleship in the near future. But for this series, for part one, I'm covering revelational knowledge about God and the two opposing worldviews of creation and evolutionary humanism. In part two, I'm covering God's revelation about himself. Part three, I'm covering the promise of a Messiah and the barriers which have arisen between God and man. And part four covers the salvation experience, or being reconciled to God. What does that mean? How does that happen? Now, considering God's revelation. Now, revelation refers to a type of knowledge that you would never discover by your human intellect and your powers of reasoning and observation alone. Basically, any past historical event has to be discovered through revelational knowledge. The issue becomes, can you trust the accounts given? And how would you evaluate them in order to place confidence in them? You know, in dealing with beginnings or origins, you have available an eyewitness revelational account in the book of Genesis, or an evolutionary naturalistic belief system, which excludes a creator or designer from its vision and foundational assumptions. In other words, two opposing worldviews, the Judeo-Christian worldview and the secular humanistic evolutionary worldview. Now, a major tenet of this humanistic worldview is that the universe is self-existing and there is no creative intelligence behind it. This view would exclude revelational knowledge as being significantly less valuable and reliable compared to what we can see, touch, and observe. And yet common sense would say that on the subject of origins, a reliable and true eyewitness account would be of utmost assistance in understanding the past. It would be a matter of evaluating accounts as one would evaluate evidence in a court of law. So let's look further at these two worldviews, one whose foundation is an eyewitness revelational knowledge, and the other which uses naturalistic, speculative assumptions as a foundation. Now, most of us arrived on this planet through no conscious choice of our own, and sometime in early childhood, the light dimly came on. You found yourself on this planet and began interacting with the life forms around you. Further observation of the world that you found yourself in proved to be a mixture of many things. On the one hand, the milk of human kindness. On the other hand, nasty human behavior of the most extreme nature. You found yourself in a world of confusing and conflicting ideas on many subjects, but especially human nature, the past, and any concept of a supreme being. You know, it seems impossible to get a truthful and accurate picture as to what is going on. How do I know if this person is telling me the truth, or if there's a hidden motive in what I hear? What is this person's worldview, and how is that worldview affecting his words and behavior? Then of supreme importance is whether this person's worldview is true and fits with reality. And even my own mind is partly clouded in this confusing world. How can I see clearly and truthfully? And what about the panoply of ideas? How do you evaluate them? Is anybody really able to give an unbiased view of things? The media claims they are unbiased, but do you really believe that? Contrary to what some may claim about being unbiased, I don't believe that is true. In fact, that isn't even the real issue. The worldview you hold is the real issue. Everyone has a worldview which determines how they look at things and what decisions they make. One sees the world through the eyeglasses of that worldview. It's really a matter of who has the correct worldview that's important. If your worldview is false, you'll be found making decisions completely out of sync with true reality and most often harmful. Now let's think further along these lines of thought. Now I have a concept that if everyone would just get along in peace, boy, what a wonderful place this would be. On the surface, this sounds appealing, but even then it would not really be a wonderful place. What about this aging and future death that I'm looking at? A life of peace and ease as I watch my body slowly age and deteriorate and endure a painful demise? Having world peace, though, on the short term a desirable thing, doesn't really answer the ultimate questions in life. And is world peace possible with the current condition of the human heart and the different competing value systems and conflicting goals that exist within the human race? Now, the evolutionary humanist worldview, with its philosophy of evolution, notice I said philosophy, not science. It tells me that time, chance, and random processes built everything, and there is nothing after my demise. Ergo, world peace would be a desirable goal, so my brief existence would not be too brutish and short, and has some pleasure in it. Evolution is a cornerstone of the Humanist Manifesto, a document that is decidedly a religious philosophical worldview. The concept of evolution is not new, but is part of Eastern religions such as Hinduism. Hinduism claims to be one of the oldest religions known to man. And in Hinduism, they have the concept of spiritual evolution. Greek philosophers such as Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S, and Anaximander, A-N-A-X-I-M-A-N-D-E-R. Tough to get my tongue around those. Had the concept of evolution as part of their ideas in around 600 BC. My point is that this is not a newly discovered idea of the modern era. It's an idea that's been around for a long time and has only been renewed in the last 120 or so years. Governments in North America currently sponsor this humanist religious philosophy in public education. The believers in the evolutionary humanist worldview seek to exclude the Judeo-Christian worldview, as well as any others, from access to the rightful share of each country's allocated education funds. The humanists hide their religious philosophy by masquerading it as science. Big quotes, science. They falsely claim that it is a science versus religion issue. The true issue is evolutionary science versus creation science. The humanist worldview versus the Judeo-Christian worldview. You see, when it comes to origins, neither the evolutionary science worldview nor the creation science worldview can prove their position by the empirical scientific method. Each worldview uses foundational assumptions which are used to interpret the world in the present and extrapolate into the past. Therefore, both can only develop a model that seeks to explain the world, the rocks, the fossils that are in the present. The model which best explains things in the present with the least amount of secondary assumptions would be the model that is most likely true. Having examined the foundational assumptions underlying the evolutionary model, I have found them to be greatly improbable and inadequate to explain anything in the present world. Evolutionary assumptions which are foundational to their belief system create their interpretations. There's no scientific method here. Let's take a brief look at some of evolution's foundational assumptions. And we're using quotes from what I would call mostly hostile witnesses, i.e. believers in evolution, who in moments of candid honesty actually support the creation model with their admissions. One foundation that is that in the distant past, out of some primordial soup, life arose from non-living materials. Yet a look into the inner workings of even the most simplest life form shows the complexity and genetic programming of the most amazing magnitude. Here's what the famous astronomer Sir Fred Hoyle said on the chance that life arose spontaneously from non-living materials and through self-assembly into higher life forms. He said that this could occur is comparable to a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and assembling a Boeing 747 jet from the materials therein. Listen to another quote from Fred Hoyle and a mathematician named Chandra Wickramasinghe. Now, both these individuals are PhDs, both evolutionists, and math is one of their strong fields. Here's their quote on the mathematical probabilities of life from non-living materials. Life cannot have had a random beginning. The trouble is that there are about 2,000 enzymes, and the chance of obtaining them all in a random trial is only one part in 10 to the 40,000, an outrageously small probability that could not be faced even if the whole universe consisted of organic soup. If one is not prejudiced either by social beliefs or by a scientific training into the conviction that life originated on Earth, this simple calculation wipes the idea entirely out of court. The enormous information content of even the simplest living systems cannot, in our view, be generated by what are often called natural processes. You know, time, chance, and random processes. For life to have originated on Earth, it would be necessary that quite explicit instruction should be provided for its assembly. There is no way in which we can expect to avoid the need for information. No way in which we can simply get by with a bigger and better organic soup, as we ourselves hoped might be possible a year or two ago. Now, another math and biology expert even adds to this. His name is Hubert Yawkey, PhD, an expert in molecular biology, information science, and mathematical probabilities, and in evolution. And he states, the building blocks do not spontaneously make proteins, at least not by chance. The origin of life by chance in a primeval soup is impossible in probability. A practical person must conclude that life didn't happen by chance. Then one last quote for this area. Nobel Prize winner, strong evolutionist and biochemist, Francis Crick, PhD, recently concluded, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to had to been satisfied to get it going. These are hostile witnesses. Could life come from non-living materials? These hostile witnesses say no, it's impossible. The obvious answer is that they were created by an infinite being of great intellectual capacity. Consider another foundation of evolution. If evolution were true, like gradualistic evolution, there should be thousands upon thousands of transitional forms found in the fossil record, as life forms gradually change from one allegedly simple one to increasingly complex ones of great variety over millions of years. But listen to these quotes from very prominent evolutionists. Consider evolutionist and paleontologist David Raup, R-A-U-P, PhD. Darwin was embarrassed by the fossil record. We are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have a quarter of a million fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. We have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. Listen to the late Dr. Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist of the British Museum of Natural History. He wrote a book called Evolution. In reply to a questioner who asked why he had not included any pictures of transitional forms, he wrote, I fully agree with your comments about the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Listen to the renowned evolutionist and Marxist Stephen Jay Gould. He wrote, The absence of fossil evidence for the intermediary stages between major transitions in organic design, indeed our inability, even in our imagination, to construct functional intermediates in many cases, has been a persistent and nagging problem for gradualistic accounts of evolution. And he went on to say, I regard the failure to find a clear vector of progress in life's history as the most puzzling fact of the fossil record. Now, Stephen Jay Gould, in being honest about gradualistic evolution, has instead proposed that what I would term as a miraculous form of evolution. He uses the term punctuated equilibrium. By this he means that for millions of years nothing much happens on the evolutionary scale, but then suddenly there are short, intense bursts of rapid evolutionary change, followed by millions of years of not much happening again, and so on. Of course, there is no workable mechanism offered for these miraculous occurrences. And so, Mr. Gould, recognizing and seeking to abandon gradualistic evolution, instead of moving towards a creation position, as a viable alternative, he proposes an even more improbable method of evolution. Consider the comments by others. Professor Louis Bonnoir, B-O-U-N-O-U-R-E. Evolution is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless. Malcolm Muggeridge. I myself am convinced that the theory of evolution, especially to the extent that it's been applied, will be one of the greatest jokes in the history books of the future. Posterity will marvel that so flimsy and dubious a hypothesis could be accepted with the incredible credulity that it has. Dr. N.T. Thamisian, T-A-H-M-I-S-I-A-N, works for the Atomic Energy Commission in the USA. He says, scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they are telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have an iota of a fact. I mean, some of these guys are getting fairly candid. Consider H.S. Lipson. In fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, although I believe that is dwindling a bit. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit in with it. It's interesting that the field of science is held hostage by this worldview. And if you hold the other worldview, which would include a deity, your employment chances are severely prejudiced. And if you publicly dissent from the religion of evolutionary humanism, you will have a high chance of becoming unemployed. I think we definitely need to free the public purse from this worldview and the people who are controlling it. Now, the rest of evolution's foundations, such as dating methods, mutations, and natural selection, are just as shaky. Consider radiometric dating. Various unstable elements will decay over time from one element to another. An example would be the decay of uranium to lead. The ages arrived at and alleged for the universe are actually created by the assumptions you choose on decay rates, and to a lesser degree by your assumption of starting quantities of each element. Long, slow decay rates yield long ages. If in the past there were substantially higher decay rates, as proposed by the creation model of Earth history, the alleged long age of the universe would be eliminated. It all depends on the truthfulness and reliability of past decay rates that you've chosen. Decay rates which are untestable, unprovable, and definitely not empirical science when you extrapolate them into the past. You would need an eyewitness of the past to get correct decay rates for the past. Consider mutations in genetic code, where one scientist has estimated that 99.99% of mutations are considered harmful for every 0.01%, which might be called good in a limited sense. You know, the weight of bad mutations to anything considered good in a living organism would cause its demise, not a living organism of higher order and complexity. Now, the sister foundation of mutation is the idea of natural selection. You've probably heard it trumpeted all over the place, mutation and natural selection. This concept is deceptively given supernatural powers and intelligence to add genetic information and programming, and then go on to build fantastically complex life forms all by time and chance. Natural selection is given the intelligence to cherry pick the exceedingly rare good mutation, to hold on to it while it cherry picks thousands more good ones, and then produce a significant change to a life form. My jaw drops with incredulity at this fairy tale. Natural selection is an evolutionary magical law, yet in reality it does absolutely nothing. Natural selection is just another way of saying that if your genetic programming deteriorates too much, you're going to die. You're not going to make it to the next generation. Listen to a few quotes on mutation and natural selection. This one by Arthur Koestler. The educated public continues to believe that Darwin has provided all the relevant answers by the magic formula of random mutation plus natural selection, quite unaware of the fact that random mutations turn out to be irrelevant and natural selection a tautology. Now, tautology is a useless repetition of an obvious idea. You know, genetic problems, you're going to die. Listen to L.P. Lester, Ph.D., and R.G. Bohlin, B-O-H-L-I-N, a Ph.D., in their book, The Natural Limits of Biological Change. With the inability of mutations of any type to produce new genetic information, the maintenance of the basic plan is to be expected. There are limits to biological change, and these limits are set by the structure and function of the genetic machinery. Consider Stephen Jay Gould again, his comments on mutations as being irrelevant. He says a mutation doesn't produce major new raw material. You don't make a new species by mutating the species. That's a common idea people have, that evolution is due to random mutations. A mutation is not the cause of evolutionary change. The essence of Darwinism lies in a single phrase, natural selection. It is claimed to be a creative force of evolutionary change. No one denies that natural selection will play a negative role in eliminating the unfit, but Darwinian theories require that it creates the fit as well. Again, another quote by Stephen Jay Gould. And here's a final one by I.L. Cohen. And the book is Darwin Was Wrong, A Study in Probabilities. And he says, to propose and argue that mutations, even in tandem with natural selection, are the root causes for 6 million viable, enormously complex species, is to mock logic, deny the weight of evidence, and reject the fundamentals of mathematical probability. Boy, I don't know about you, but I don't see these type of quotes and comments in our regular media. You know, to keep trumpeting this evolutionary worldview in schools and the media seems to me to be some kind of mass deception and brainwashing of the highest order. Or perhaps the media has become too lazy to even check out the validity of these assumptions used to prop up their exclusive pronouncements to the regular public. You know, what worldview is held by the media? Do you ever see any time given to the creation worldview in the regular media? Well, perhaps we'll see the hidden author of the evolutionary humanist worldview later in our talk on knowledge by revelation. Let's look at a number of ideas and how they fit with the Judeo-Christian worldview versus the evolutionary humanist worldview, consider this popular slogan. With regards to life, it's the journey that's important, not the destination. Enjoy the journey to the fullest. Follow your dreams. Well, the humanist worldview believes that there is no moral absolutes, no creator to which one will give an account, no devil, no afterlife, and so on. His view of the world would be supportive of emphasizing the journey over the destination. For what else is there? However, the Judeo-Christian worldview would be entirely opposed to the statement. Opposed to the statement. You see, the destination in the Judeo-Christian worldview is infinitely more important than the journey. You need to be reconciled to the Creator to determine your destination at life's end. It should be obvious that both worldviews cannot be true at the same time. One is true, one is a lie. One view represents true reality, one false. Consider the fruit of the humanist worldview. For the humanist, right and wrong is determined by consensus, or whoever is in power, or who gets the most votes. If you're on the wrong side of this process, look out. Laws will likely be passed to silence you, or outright do away with you. For the Judeo-Christian worldview, moral absolutes are laid out and unchanging. They are not voted in and out and adjusted by special lobby groups. You know, some of the first humanists which implemented their worldview, the evolutionary worldview, were Stalin and Mao Zedong. Stalin was most supportive of Charles Darwin's book and worldview. Unfortunately for millions of citizens who were on the wrong side of Stalin and Mao's new worldview and version of floating morality, being murdered was the result. Can that happen in the West? Already is happening. Millions of unborn children have been murdered by doctors and nurses with the consent of the mother and sometimes the urging of the father. All this behavior has as part of its foundation evolution, and also the removal of the idea of a creator from the minds of men, women, and children through public education, literature, and the media. Now let us suppose that the secular humanist worldview is a big lie. What will true reality look like? Suppose that the Judeo-Christian worldview represents the true reality of life on earth and life in the hereafter. Think of each person that lived on earth will stand alone in God's courtroom before the Lord Jesus Christ and give an account of what he did, how he influenced people, and what example he showed. How is that abortion provider going to fare? How are Stalin, Hitler, and Mao going to fare? Pol Pot? How is that man who fornicated with his girlfriend and urged her to kill an unborn child going to fare? How is that teacher who misled children with false evolutionary worldview going to fare? How is that judge and politician who approved and made laws supporting the moral perversion of sodomy going to fare? How is a man or woman who practiced sexual immorality with one partner after another going to fare? Well, the outcome will be determined by the true worldview, whether you subscribe to it or not. In the book of Matthew, Jesus says, it is better for a person to have a millstone hung around their neck and drowned in the deepest ocean than to mislead a child on the important issues of life. You think about our society, they look at these teachers and these teachers' unions who say they're doing such a wonderful job and are so needed. You know, if the Judeo-Christian worldview is true, they are facing some of the harshest judgment to come. I would hope they would turn around. There's still time. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now, Eastern religions offer one concept called reincarnation. Reincarnation involves a continual treadmill of dying and coming back to earth as a lower or higher life form, depending upon your performance in your past life. I believe that the buzzword used is karma. Of course, measuring that performance is a moving target, so who knows what you will come back as. Then, of course, getting off the treadmill will take how long? And how did you say I could get off again? How can I know for sure? You know, I find myself a bit prone to selfishness and bouts of bad behavior, especially if something similar to the Ten Commandments is used to measure my performance. I am not that confident I will ever get off the reincarnation treadmill. You know, the sun and the stars are eventually going to burn out and the universe is going to suffer a heat death. I'm sure some living entity descended from myself will still be on Earth trying to pay off my karmic debt. Wow, an endless treadmill of aging and dying. How comforting and satisfying is that? Perhaps if you like horror stories, there has got to be a true reality better than this. Well, okay, if I put aside some of these intellectually untenable belief systems, such as evolution and reincarnation, there's really only one logical, viable option left. A supreme being, a supreme intelligence, a creator. A being that would have to be outside of this universe, not part of it. A personal being, not an impersonal being. A being of infinite intelligence and power in order to construct and design what I see on this planet. But as I look around the planet, this supreme being does not appear to be fully in charge of what was created. How would you explain that? I can see glimpses of virtue and honorable conduct seemingly overpowered by the ugliness and selfishness of human behavior in the headlines. I see aging and death. And if there was a supreme being that infinite, how would he communicate to me, a finite physical being? Well, a supreme being would have to communicate at my finite level. He would have to either speak out loud so I could hear, or he would have to write in a language that I could read. And would this supreme being tell me everything that he knows? Well, no. I would not have the time nor the lifespan to sift through everything that a supreme being would know. An infinite being would have to determine what revelations were important to communicate. An infinite being would have to give me a revelation of himself, the beginning of creation, and any important details that I would need to know. Like, who am I? Why am I like the way that I am? Why is the planet like it is? Where is it all going? After all, you and I woke up late on this planet, in ignorance, and we're only here for a brief period of time. What could we know about these things unless there was a revelation that was true, accurate, and trustworthy? So if there is a creator of the universe, a personal creator, and all the life forms in it, where is that revelation? There really is only one credible book that makes that claim and can be examined as to its validity. That book is the Old and New Testaments, which combined are known as the Bible. This set of scriptures claims to be a revelation from the Creator. What is its basic message, and how can one have confidence that it is true? Well, since the subject is outside the realm of empirical science, we are left with the approach common in a court of law. We can bring the common tests of evidence and deductions that any court judge would use to render a verdict. Things such as eyewitness accounts, credible witnesses, physical evidences, and other historical records can be examined. These methods can lead one to whether or not the Bible is an accurate description of the past and present reality on planet Earth. You know, in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 6, it says that there were over 500 eyewitnesses who saw Jesus Christ after his resurrection. Now, that would be a heavy piece of evidence in any court of law. 500 eyewitness accounts of meeting the Lord Jesus Christ after his resurrection. But let's look at the basic message of the revelation first. That might shed some light on present conditions. You know, God reveals himself as the creator of the space-time continuum, and physical matter also. He gives an eyewitness account of the creation in Genesis. He also reveals that he is one God, yet three distinct persons, a plurality of beings and a unity, God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, and God the Son. Genesis 1 verse 26 records, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness." Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. One big difference between man and the animal kingdom is the ability to reason and think in an abstract manner, to develop morality and conscience. But that's another subject. I would digress. But notice the plurality in this verse. Throughout the revelation, God presents himself as a trinity of persons. This is one area where God has revealed something about himself, but in our finiteness, in my finiteness, your finiteness, we are not going to totally grasp the height, breadth, and depth of this. And this should not cause one to stumble at this point. There will be many points in the revelation that, because of our finiteness and his infiniteness, complete understanding will not be gained. We will see that God will predict the future in advance, and the prediction will come true precisely as the revelation stated. Bible prophecy. As a finite being, I cannot comprehend how an infinite being can bring this to pass, but it is one of the heavy evidences that the Bible is a revelation from the true Creator, unlike the claims of other religious books. We will look in greater detail at prophecy in another series, but I'll mention just a bit briefly. Listen to God's declaration of the prophetic nature of the Bible and his declarations. Isaiah 46, verses 9 and 10. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Now God declares history in advance in the Bible, and he says that he will bring it to pass. As an example, trace the promises to the nation of Israel. They were promised in the Old Testament to be brought back to their homeland in the last days of history. For your own reading, you can look at Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 21 to 28. Also Ezekiel chapter 38. You look at Jeremiah chapter 30, especially verse 3. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 10 to 12. You know, that return to her homeland for the nation of Israel happened in May of 1948. And we are watching the clouds of the book of Revelation develop in our generation. Elsewhere in prophecy it says, God will complete in one generation all the prophecies relating to the return of Jesus Christ, setting up his millennial kingdom, in the final new kingdom and new earth. And that generation would be the first one to see the nation of Israel brought back again from exile a second time. And that happened in May of 1948. The first time Israel was exiled was, the 10 tribes were exiled in 721 BC to Assyria. And the tribes Judah and Benjamin lasted a little longer. They were centered around Jerusalem. They were exiled in 586 BC to Babylonia. Now moving on to the eyewitness, back to the eyewitness account of creation, it reveals a world very much different than the one we experience now. God declares in Exodus 20, verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Also in Genesis 1, verse 31, he says, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Very good means it was perfect. Perfect physically and morally. You know, the creation, the initial creation, there's no death in God's initial creation. It was not built upon a mountain of fossil graveyards. You know, there were a number of unique features of the original creation that bear mentioning. In Genesis 1, verse 6 to 8, there is a description of a protective water canopy over the earth, which protected the environment from harmful radiation and provided a greenhouse effect from pole to pole. There was no ice cap and polar regions in the pre-flood world. The original creation did not have rain and violent weather patterns, as the canopy balanced the temperatures out around the world. It says in Genesis 2, verse 5 and 6, that a mist went up from the earth and watered the ground. it indicates that there was a subterranean water system to provide optimal growing conditions for vegetation. It is also thought that there was more land mass and less ocean, as a large amount of water was within the earth, designed to be in there, in a subterranean system, as well as in the water canopy. The original creation, which included the animal kingdom, was vegetarian, as mentioned in Genesis 1, verse 30. The first man, Adam, and woman, Eve, were created genetically and morally perfect and given dominion over their work, over the earth. Now, we also have a revelation of the spirit world. For God has revealed that as part of his perfect creation, he created angelic spirits. At this point in time, both angelic spirits and Adam and Eve were in proper relationship to God. We read in Job 30, verse 7, that when the creation was finished, all the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The term sons of God refers to angelic spirits as they witnessed the original creation in all its perfection and beauty. Now, obviously, you and I have entered the time continuum around 6,000 years after creation week, and we observe a decidedly different world than the original creation. What happened? Again, we must continue on in the revelation given to us in the early chapters of Genesis. Three cataclysmic events occurred. The first happened in the angelic realm. As created free-willed spirits, a third of them, headed by the angel who led worship in heaven, withdrew their submission from God. Oh, he's still leading worship. Have you ever been to a rock concert? I guess I want to digress. I'd like to digress here for quite a while. You know, many rock stars have taken the Faustian bargain. What is this bargain? Remember, have you heard of this scene in the book of Matthew? It's in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 and then 8, 9, and 10. It says, "Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Again, the devil taketh him up into an exceedingly high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And the devil said unto him, All these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me. Then saith Jesus unto him, Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." You know, if you're willing to serve and promote the God of this world's ways, then the reward can be fame, money, popularity, and women. Get the picture? The Faustian bargain has a great amount of truth to it. Interestingly enough, many of these rock stars claim that it's like another spiritual entity that possesses them when they play on stage. Another spiritual entity that possesses them when they play on stage. Interesting. And what is the basic message? Rebellion against any authority, glorifying alcohol and drug use, and sexual immorality. And you can throw in a lot of occult practices that are warned against in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Read it for yourself. What a world. But let's get back to the fall of Lucifer. We went a little bit ahead. So in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12 to 16, and Ezekiel 28, verse 12 to 19, we get a glimpse of this rebellion of the leader of worship in heaven. And in the scriptures, a number of names are given this angelic leader: Satan, Lucifer, the dragon, the father of lies, the murderer, the serpent, the deceiver, the angel of light. Now, angel of light would be a reference to appearing to be a follower of God, but not being a true follower of God. But it's worth reading the verses in Isaiah, starting in Isaiah 14, verse 12, going to verse 16. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. Now, that's a reference to the Jewish temple in the last days. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And verse 15 says, yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms? Now part of these verses speak directly about Lucifer, and part speak of Lucifer's world leader in the end times, known as the Antichrist, written about in the book of Revelation, chapters 6 to 19. The reference to the Mount of Congregation in the sides of the north, as I said before, refers to the temple in Jerusalem in the last days, where Antichrist, controlled and indwelt by Lucifer, will enter the temple and declare that he is God. And of course, we'll see that he loses in Revelation chapter 19 as the Lord returns. But for our purposes here, we want to note the self-willed declarations that Lucifer makes. He went from having his will in submission to God to actively declaring his independence and opposition to God. In fact, vying for the same role, the same position, the same honor, the same glory. You know, the stage for conflict in the unseen spirit realm is set. Lucifer was the first self-willed being with its resultant antagonism against the Creator. God reveals Lucifer's work and influence in the second cataclysmic event. The second cataclysmic event occurred in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve had been placed there with only one prohibition, not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, with a warning that the consequences were death, spiritual and physical. You see, they only had one commandment to obey, not ten, that were given to the nation of Israel, and they lived in a perfect world. At this point in time, Adam and Eve had perfect, peaceful fellowship with God, and the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, the second person of the Trinity, indwelt their hearts and communed with their human spirits. In this perfect world and in perfect fellowship with God, Adam and Eve were naked, a definitely unique time of history. It is thought by some that Adam and Eve were clothed in God's Shekinah glory, kind of like a veil of light, as part of the Spirit of God indwelling in their hearts. Enter in the serpent, or enter in Lucifer through the serpent, who through deception challenged the truthfulness of what God had said about eating of the fruit. The serpent called God a liar and said that Eve was missing out on a promotion to godhood. Sadly, what Lucifer said would be the ascent of man actually resulted in the descent of man. The account is given in Genesis chapter 3, if you want to read it in detail. Both Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, disobeying the one commandment God had given. A number of results entered into their lives as well as the perfect creation. Both Adam and Eve experienced spiritual separation from God and became self-willed beings, losing their moral compass and peace of mind. The Spirit of God with the Shekinah glory had to withdraw from Adam and Eve due to sin. Sin is disobedience to God's commandments and moral character. Separation from God brought them under the power of sin, and in a secondary way, the power of Satan, the power of Lucifer, who deceived them in the garden. Now, the power of sin resulted in man's mind to be in a state of enmity or antagonistic rebellion against God. Aging and death entered the human race. Aging and wearing down of the creation began. What is known as the second law of thermodynamics kicked in. The second law says that everything left to itself tends to disorder and decay. Another term for this is entropy. The universe started to wear down and wear out. In this fallen state, God promised that he would restore the human race and the creation back to a perfect relationship with him. There was a promise of a Messiah who would bridge the gulf of separation that had come between God and man. There was a teaching that the penalty for sin or disobedience would eventually be handled by a perfect blood sacrifice as payment in God's court of law. So with a third of the angels and Adam and Eve now separated from God, the stage was set for cataclysm event number 3. The fruit of the sin nature is revealed relatively quickly in Genesis chapter 4 as Adam and Eve's sons, Cain and Abel, brought their offering to God. Now Cain brought the fruit of his hands, his good works. But Abel, he brought a blood sacrifice of a lamb, which provided a temporary covering for sin and acknowledged the need for God's perfect sacrifice, which was to come. Cain's offering was not accepted, but Abel's was. The resultant animosity of Cain led to his murdering his brother. Thus we see quickly the fruit of what God calls the sin nature of man. You know, each person born after Adam and Eve are born separated from God and under the power of the sin nature. Now, as a side note, a common question on Genesis is where did Cain and Abel get their wives? Well, in Genesis 5, verse 4, it states that Adam and Eve had many sons and daughters. So obviously Cain would have married a sister. But is that not prohibited, you say? Well, at this time, no, it was not. The genetic pool of the human race was still very strong, and marrying a close relative did not manifest genetic problems in the offspring. The prohibition of marrying close relatives did not come in until the nation of Israel received instructions in Leviticus chapter 18, around 1400 BC. By this time, deterioration in the human genetic pool had reached a point where marrying close relatives carried a great possibility of genetic defects in the offspring. We digress, I know, but this is a common question that arises from Genesis. The human race, as it grew and multiplied, still enjoyed the benefits of the canopy which protected the earth from the constant bombardment of cosmic radiation and much of the good growing conditions that it provided. We see that under these conditions, the aging and deterioration of the environment was slower, and the human bodies were able to live almost 1,000 years. However, the power of sin was growing, fueled by human self-will and the fallen angels working on the minds of men. Remember Lucifer had vowed to oppose God and take his place? We look in Genesis chapter 6, especially verses 5 and 11 to 13, that the earth was filled with violent and morally depraved humans whose minds were only thinking evil continually. Only one family, Noah's, was left, who had sought God through recognizing their need for a perfect blood sacrifice and a future Messiah to deliver them from the power and the penalty of sin. All others had rejected the message and followed the crowd. Planet Earth had become the center stage for conflict, both in the spiritual and the physical realm. It is worth mentioning again that both Lucifer and mankind, in withdrawing submission of their wills to the Creator, received a rebellious animosity towards the Creator. And I mentioned the word before, another word used for that is enmity. It's kind of like you stiffen your will against somebody in authority and don't let them tell you what to do. It's that type of attitude towards God that exists in the human heart. We see in Genesis chapter 6 that it took only around 1600 years for the human race and Lucifer to bring about a house of horrors, totally corrupt in the original, pristine, perfect creation. A number of questions arise as to why a good creator would allow things to get this bad. Is he powerless? Won't he do something? What was he doing? I believe a couple of thoughts can be offered, although in my finiteness, they can only be partially satisfactory. The revelation indicates that fallen angels cannot be restored to a relationship with God, but humans can. My thought is that if God zapped every human the moment they did their first sin, or once you reached a certain number of sins, they would be forever separated from God and not have an opportunity for a restored relationship. You know, by this point alone, God has to allow a period of time for this process of restoration. He has to withhold immediate judgment of every sin so the opportunity of reconciliation can happen. God's desire is for all to come to repentance and a restored relationship with Him. By this declared point of revelation alone, He will only bring judgment when absolutely necessary to fulfill His overall plan. So presently He is tolerating but not condoning sin, and in many places He has indicated that his cup of judgment is filling up. He will tolerate the evil of Lucifer and the human race, but not forever. Now, it is thought by some that besides the violence and moral corruption, there was also the corruption of the human genome going on as well. And with these three factors combined, they brought God's judgment through Noah's flood. You know, in Genesis 6, verse 4, a very unusual statement is made. We'll read it. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them. The same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. It would appear from a straightforward reading of this verse that fallen angels have been able to have sexual relations with women and created a corrupted hybrid race. It has been suggested that the Greek legends of Titans, you know, half god, half man, may be an allusion to these events. It is thought that Lucifer used this tactic to attempt to corrupt the human race so that it would be unable to provide a fully and truly human Messiah as promised, who would deliver the human race from the fall into sin. If successful, God's promise would be negated and the battle would be won. In the New Testament, in the book of Jude, verses 6 and 7 seem to support this. And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them, in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. You know, just as Sodom and Gomorrah was known for unnatural sexual depravity, you know, men with men and women with women, it appears also that there was a group of fallen angels engaged in unnatural sexual behavior. It would seem that this group of angels is currently imprisoned and not available for Lucifer to use in the current battle. The baddest of the bad, you might say, had to be locked up. The time for God's judgment had arrived. But even then, he warned them through Noah for 120 years, a most gracious period of time in which he had to endure only evil continually as he looked upon this fallen planet. The New Testament describes the time before the flood as one of building, eating and drinking, and great sexual immorality, and ignoring the warnings of Noah. Can you imagine the poor timing of putting all your efforts towards your earthly residence and treasures, and in the next instant, everything swept away in the deluge and flood? Our current generation is doing the exact same thing, ignoring God and focused on building earthly possessions and enjoying the pleasures of sin for a season. And we also are on the brink of the tribulation days of the book of Revelation, where there will be earthquakes so great that all the cities of the world will collapse. Talk about a real estate devaluation. Should you be investing all your time in building a real estate portfolio? Getting the next bigger house? The next bigger house? At a time when the judgment of God is on the horizon? Let's read parts of this eyewitness account of the flood of Noah. We're going to read Genesis chapter 6, verse 5 to 14, and then Genesis 7, verse 11 to 9, 11 to 24, and then three verses in Genesis 8, verse 1 to 3. Starting in Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. Now, perfect does not mean perfect morally or without any sin. It has more the meaning of maturity and learning how to walk with God and use God's power to obey. Continuing in verse 10, "And Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, The end of all flesh is come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood, rooms thou shalt make in the ark, and shalt pitch it within and without with pitch." Now moving to Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up." All the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Some tectonic events are situated here. "And the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. In the selfsame day Noah entered the ark, and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. They and every beast after his kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and every fowl after his kind, and every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark, two and two of all flesh, wherein is the breath of life. And they that went in, male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded, and the Lord shut them in." I wanted to mention that dinosaurs were land animals. So I think dinosaurs went on the ark. Now you might say, well, how did God take giant dinosaurs on the ark? It would have been a pretty big boat. Well, if you think about it, you'd probably take young adults, right? You wouldn't take the biggest full-grown ones. But keep that in mind. We're going to talk about dinosaurs a little bit later in this presentation. Continuing in verse 17, "And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bare up the ark, and it was lifted up above the earth. And the waters prevailed and were increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark went upon the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits, that's 20 to 30 feet, upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered." That means every piece of land was covered by, let's say, 30 feet of water. "And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both fowl and of cattle and of beasts and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land died, and every living substance was destroyed." I'm assuming this is talking about the pre-flood vegetation. "Which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle, and the creeping things, and the fowl of the heaven, and they were destroyed from the earth, and Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Now reading the first three verses of Genesis chapter 8. "And God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. The fountains also of the deep, and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters returned from off the land continually. And after the end of 150 days, the waters were abated." Here we have an eyewitness account of the destruction of the pre-flood world. I want to focus on Genesis 7, verse 11, where it states that the great fountains of the deep broke up, and the windows of heaven were opened. We have a general concept that the pre-flood world had a protective canopy of water. The earth was specially designed to grow food, and the planet itself was perfectly designed within, right down to the inner core, to support the full genetic expression of every living thing. But we see a tremendous tectonic cataclysm encased in verse 11. The implications are an internal meltdown of the earth with tremendous pressures developing, ripping apart the earth's crust, and vast volumes of superheated subterranean water that were within the original earth blowing up onto the surface and even into the canopy. Tremendous volcanic activity occurs of immense size, blowing through the canopy, putting immense quantities of volcanic ash into the air. Massive lava and mud flows occur. Tidal actions moving things around. The protective canopy is disrupted and precipitates onto the earth, bringing great changes in the previously stable weather patterns. Every air-breathing life form dies except those preserved by Noah and the Ark. There are many late flood and post-flood adjustments. As the earth's surface and crust recovers, ocean basins sink deeper and land masses rise, causing the water to drain off the continents into the now deeper basins. Psalm 104, verse 6 to 9 records these crustal adjustments. And if we look around our world, we see lots of what are called underfit rivers. Massive canyons that at one time seemed to flow great volumes of water, but now they're just a small amount in the bottom of the canyon. An underfit river. That would seem to be that these underfit rivers were cut and carved at the time when the water drained off the continents into the deeper basins. It would seem to fit. Now, with the oceans holding a great amount of heat from the meltdown of the earth and the heat generated through these tectonic activities, it would cause a large amount of evaporation. And as these clouds came over the cooler land masses, you would have longer and heavier snowfalls in the northern and southern hemispheres, creating a virtual ice age until equilibrium was established, till the oceans gave off most of their heat, and then a meltback would occur towards the poles. Now, I do not intend to deal with the whole evolution versus creation battle. There are many websites, books, videos, and materials available which will go into deeper detail. I will, however, mention a few points related to the world we observe today. Everything we see in this physical world today, sediments, rocks, fossils, coal, has to be interpreted as related to origins. The word sediment refers to muds, shales, and gravels, etc., which have been deposited by moving waters and upon drying out have solidified into those rock layers. One well-known creation speaker says it this way: we can observe billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. An accurate description of the present. Did you know that in many deposits, fossils of markedly different ecosystems are found together, all broken up, jumbled in massive fossil graveyards? How did fossils of different ecosystems get buried in the same graveyard? Were you aware that in order to get a fossil, the life form has to be buried rapidly in order to preserve it? Have you ever thought about vegetation in the pre-flood world? Greater landmass, smaller oceans, fantastic, perfect growing conditions. There must have been an immense amount of vegetation in the pre-flood world. Where did it go? If there was a flood, what happened to the vegetation? Have you ever considered coal and its origin? Did you know that coal is metamorphed plant material? Both evolutionists and creationists agree on this. Just not how it got there. Many coal seams are found with tree logs and stumps interspersed throughout. Has this been publicized a lot in general media? Many of the trees found in coal have been like pine trees as well as other types which do not like to grow in a lot of water. They don't grow in swamps. The evolutionary explanation that coal is formed growing in place and in a swamp over thousands of years, perhaps millions of years, just does not fit with reality. For sure, there are some coal seams formed from plants that would enjoy a watery environment, but that would be expected in a luxurious pre-flood world of tropical and subtropical vegetation. There is generally a big debate on whether layers underlying coal represent the original soil and therefore support the growth in place swamp explanation, or whether they've been transported there and the layers do not represent any type of soil at all. the swamp explanation I find to be, and claiming that the layers beneath the coal are the original soil, I find to be an evolutionary interpretation to fit their belief system. They're looking at it through their evolutionary glasses, and they're blinded to an alternative explanation that fits the facts a lot better. You know, the observable evidence of the layers under and between coal seams is quite a stretch to claim that these represent growth-in-place soils. You know, it looks as if the layers under and between coal layers have occurred under water transport and do not show forth the composition of any type of original soil. But the debate's going to continue for a long time. It never will end, will it? Were you aware that it does not take millions of years to form coal, only the right conditions? They have been able to make coal in the lab in only 30 days. I believe they used heat, pressure, acidic water, and a type of clay similar to volcanic ash. The flood would have created these very similar conditions. The vegetation ripped up would have started to decay and made the water acidic. The internal meltdown of the earth would have provided heat, mud flows for pressure, volcanoes for a clay-type volcanic ash, and the Earth's tidal systems for layering of deposits. Interesting, no? Were you aware that they have found soft, elastic dinosaur tissue and pliable blood vessels in the thigh bone of a T-Rex fossil? Let me say that again. They have found soft, elastic dinosaur tissue and pliable blood vessels in the thigh bone of a T-Rex fossil. You know, how old do you really think dinosaurs are? We know that soft tissue and pliable blood vessels cannot last 64 million years old, or however long on the scale of evolution you want to put dinosaurs in. How does this fit? Does it not fit with the creation model in a much, much better way? Have you considered the description of a large sauropod dinosaur found in the post-flood book of Job? Job's a book in the Old Testament. He was a post-flood patriarch just like Abraham was. The reference is in Job chapter 40, verse 15 to 24. It describes a creature with a tail like a cedar tree and legs like pillars of bronze. Some Bibles have footnotes saying this could be a hippo or an elephant or a crocodile. But does the description really fit? I don't think so. Did Job live with dinosaurs after the flood? I believe he did. Were you aware of the gigantism found in life forms in the fossil record as compared to their smaller cousins found today? Would living in a special pre-flood world with perfect growing conditions relate to this? So far, the revelation looks like this. There is a creator who is carrying out a plan to restore his creation to its perfect state. There is a great number of fallen angels whose purpose is to thwart this plan any way that they can. An unseen battle. You know, not every thought that comes into your head is your own. Think about that. A great spiritual battle is raging in the heavens and on the earth. There is a race of human beings who are self-willed, each pursuing their own selfish goals, each person under their own version of what they think is right and wrong, if anything. As human wills and plans quite naturally collide, there is war and evil and turmoil breaking out all over the place. Such is the revelation of the Bible. My point to you is, does the picture fit with what we see and experience? Put yourself in Lucifer's battle plan. What would you do? Well, we can observe what he did in the Garden of Eden. He sought to create doubt about the truthfulness of the Bible. He called God a liar. He called God a liar about Adam and Eve dying if they disobeyed what God had said, the one commandment. Would you not expect the Word of God to be attacked, misinterpreted, and suppressed as part of Lucifer's plans to oppose God? Would you not expect a world full of false ideas and religious belief systems in order to bring confusion everywhere? Would you not expect many counterfeits of true religion? Would you not expect a great propaganda machine about the pleasures of sin without any consequences? Think of the marketing of unholywood. The marketing of unholywood. That's Hollywood, if you like the secular term. Have you ever thought of why a faithful, monogamous, married man and woman never get any sexually transmitted diseases? Did you know that sexually transmitted diseases are a result of sin? Read Romans 1, verse 24 to 27. It says that man, if he commits sexual sin, is going to receive a recompense in his own body. There's going to be a consequence in his own body. You know, God in his grace has allowed man to discover some cures for sexual sin. But many at present are incurable and a lifelong penalty, or a penalty that leads to death. Think of AIDS. You know, a condom will not deliver you. Think about Cain for a moment. As a fallen self-willed being, he did not deny there was a God, but what did he do? He tried to come to God through his good works, through human self-effort and self-improvement, bypassing the need to deal with the penalty of sin. Do you know how big the good works self-improvement industry is? Visit your local bookstore sometime. Cain was a human founder of false religion and the self-improvement movement, where you set up a code of behavior with a few rituals, but you bypass God's way of coming into a relationship with him. And with that cloak of religion or human self-improvement on, you still get to be in charge of your own life. It is important to mention that to a great extent, God must respect the choices of self-willed beings, both angelic and human. Both groups were endowed with choice. And we see that God will honor the right of choice no matter how devastating and destructive those choices may be. I don't say that I understand this fully because I'm not infinite, but I do see this freedom. But it is a freedom that carries responsibility and accountability before God. The world trumpets the idea of freedom of expression, no censorship. But by this they mean and use the idea to lead people into deeper levels of depravity and more expressions of sinful behavior and mental bondage. You know, God offers the freedom to not sin and the freedom to do what is right. That, I believe, is the real freedom that each of us needs to seek. So we labor under three cataclysmic events according to God's revelation. Lucifer's fight against God, man's broken relationship with God, and the earth's environmental destruction in Noah's flood. What then is God doing? He is fulfilling his plan set out in the prophetic part of the scriptures, in spite of the opposition of fallen angels and humans. The Spirit of God is restraining evil, both angelic and human. He is convicting people of their sin and their need to come into a restored relationship with God through the Messiah. He is restoring the nation of Israel so all prophetic promises can be fulfilled. We will now turn for a session on what God reveals about himself and trace a bit through the line of the Messiah, from the promise in Genesis through the Old Testament into the New Testament. May God's revelation take root in your heart and mind as we further look into these things. May you pick up God's revelation, read, and let the Spirit of God speak to you. And for the English-speaking world, I would only recommend the King James Version of the Bible, it being based upon reliable Greek and Hebrew manuscripts, as opposed to the more modern versions. But that's another issue for another day. May God bless.